sometimes they're self-dipoles. You know, you can make vertical halfway dipoles, and they really don't need any kind of radio system. If so, you do have 5/8 or a quarter. You definitely do, unless you play some kind of trick and you make your coaxial cable a counterpoise, and then it's going to distort the radiation pattern, as you mentioned. So, yeah, if you don't have a radial line for an antenna design that will, in a pinch, use your coax cable as a counterpoise, you'll have a different radiation pattern. So I would tend to agree with you. It sort of depends on the design of and the reason why the manufacturer says you don't need a radio. Occasionally it's truthful. Most times it's a lie.
19-5.
N2VA Mobile on Echo 1.
Wesley, recognize N2VH?
N2VHZ on Echo 1. Mobile.
Okay, sorry. I see you here on my little screen off to the side. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you're done with the antenna, could you come back to have an off-topic information to bring up? Not about the antenna. Another topic.
Okay, I'll keep you in mind. I think we're kind of almost finished with the antenna, but then Wesley was kind of interrupted with the talk of the antenna, so when we get done with Wesley, I'll pull back to you. How's that?
Okay, if I don't answer, that means I'm out of range because I'm in Nebraska and kind of sporadic. I'm sorry if I'm not able to answer, but that'll be what happens. Sorry about that.
No problem, Ken. Yeah, I see you here on the screen, and if you drop out, I'll recognize that you had to leave us. So give us a little time, and hopefully we'll get back to you, and you can add to the discussion.
Thank you. But what I have is, like, super interesting. You wouldn't believe it. Okay. Well, I am mobile. Thank you.
Okay. Just to kind of jump back to Ed for a minute or two. Any opinions or the comments that I made?
I didn't see, that's all.
Okay, good. Two great minds think alike. Very good. Wesley, do you have more things?
Yeah, I have only two things. If it takes 1 minute per subject, then we have a 3 minute span. So, Teflon pulse clutches, which would be the health hazard for every house. Then you spoke about Umauma, but just a few words if you want. And then lab-grown black hole. We start from the last one. Physicists from University of Amsterdam use the chain of atoms in single file to gain further understanding about the behavior of the black hole. So, back to you.
Okay, that's a very interesting subject. What they really made is called a Bose-Einstein condensate. It is a small collection of individual atoms, super cool to the point where they possess a merged quantum identity. So they act as a single atom. They're not really black holes. Some of the behaviors of Bose-Einstein condensates are similar to black holes, and so since it's far easier to make a Bose-Einstein condensate, not very easy, but easier than a black hole, it's one of the best ways of looking at the similarities and the difference. So that's very interesting. It's not something that any of us could do at home, but it's interesting.
Yeah, you mentioned about the Bose-Einstein. You mentioned about both Einstein condensate. That would be what a state of matter that is formed by gas or bosons with low densities or very low densities when cooled to -273.15, which is much lower than liquid nitrogen that was 197, yeah, or minus 457.67 Fahrenheit, if we talk not about Celsius. That would be conditions where a large fraction of boson occupied the lowest quantum state, right? If I remember correctly. Back to you.
Yeah, there's bosons and there's fermions. Fermions cannot occupy the same quantum state. Bosons can. So you got a bunch of things that amount to bosons, and you put them enough, and they act as a single entity with a little wave function.
There's nothing you think. I remember the researchers from the Tech Union Israel Institute of Technology. They created a similar thing, which they stated confirmed Hawking's predictions. There would be Hawking's radiation that right from nothing, but three.
Well, again, it's problematic. It suggests that, but again, Bose condensates are not classically identical to black holes. They do not have the gravitational field. They do not have the warped space-time. They do not have the physics-breaking singularity at its core. They just share a lot of similar characteristics. And I don't know how much it correlates with Hawking's radiation, which is a special case phenomena for quantum gravity. But, you know, I guess it's useful information. Whether you can make it, you know, fit it entirely or suggest it, I'm not quite sure.
Okay, a few words about Uma. Strange thing is, it looks like a spaceship, it's not. Oh, you mentioned about a physicist who believes that it's a spacecraft. Back to you.
Yes, as much as I'm dubious about Elon Musk, I'm not dubious about Avi Loeb. Avi Loeb is a hack, trying to sell books sometimes. And, you know, all you have to do is say, I just saw a rock. And it will say, oh, it's probably an alien spaceship. So Avi Loeb did what Avi Loeb always does and announced that it's very likely it could be an alien spaceship when it's just a misformed rock. Not all rocks are shaped like boulders. They come in all kinds of shapes and sizes, and depending upon their geometry, they experience different responses to gravitational forces of the sun. So it was just an asteroid, it was not a spaceship. Avi Loeb had to wander off someplace and type up a new book about aliens to make a buck out of
A few words about his unusual moving patterns. The origin is from different galaxies that I know. It's kind of flat. It's interesting when you look at it.
The problem with Maumau is it's an irregularly shaped asteroid with water on one side and not on the other. So when gravity works on it, it causes it to tumble. When it tumbles, the direction of the part that has ice particles changes its velocity a little bit. So if you didn't know anything about astronomy, like Avi Loeb apparently doesn't, you say, well, it's changing its direction. It must have an engine.
Okay, so that's about Uma. Or Uma. I don't know how to pronounce it properly. Teflon scratches. So we have a problem where millions or billions of small particles, a huge amount of the plastic could be swallowed from scratch cooking pan, and the suggestion is to throw it out when you have a scratch. Maybe good for business. Back to you.
Well, in general, if you're using Teflon, you want it to be stick-proof. If it's scratched, the scratch is not stick-proof, so That's a good reason to throw it out. Plastic is all around us. We're probably filled with microparticles of plastic. I think I talked earlier that eventually, probably evolution will evolve organisms that are able to digest fluorocarbons and all kinds of things and get rid of it. But until then, we'll have a bunch of deposits of microplastics. Are they dangerous? I don't know. People are working on it. And once someone has proof, even before someone has proof, someone will raise the specter of we're all filling ourselves with microplastics. You know, when in doubt, try not to eat plastic. It's probably not good for you.
There was some article how many credit cards the Americans eat per minute in the United States if you take the all plastic eating by us. But I don't have accurate data on any of it. Okay, I believe that would be all for now. I have a different subject which is related to antenna below 50 hertz, but there is a person waiting in Dakota, if I remember, a wave interesting subject. So back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay, I think he's on the border, so sometimes he's in Nebraska, sometimes not. Ken, you appear to still be out there. Can you tell us what you want to tell us?
This is NQPHD Mobile. Sometimes I operate as NQPHD stroke zero when I'm in South Dakota. I reside Monday to Friday in the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is in the lower half of South Dakota. Pine Ridge Reservation is interesting. It's the sovereign nation of the Lakota people. The size of Connecticut, or twice as big as Long Island. Forest area in North America. And I'm a federal officer, so I have a housing area I live in, about an eighth of a mile around. Now, they provide 24-hour security for us there. And the Lakota people allow us to reside there. And we help them out. One night I heard a very, some of you might have spoke to me. When you talk to me, I operate on a low band at 10 to 8 stroke 0. And one night I was looking with my windows open during the summer, I heard a noise and went, boing. And the entire housing area vibrated. I talked to some of my friends. They also heard that. It was really loud. It came from above and everything shook. It woke everybody up. And strangely enough, you know, that tribe has about 60 to 80 missing people that don't know where they go. What do you think about that, back in control?
Well, I can't tell you for sure, but lately I would be suspicious that some piece of Chinese rocket fell on them. Paul probably knows far better than me the tendency of Chinese spacecraft to just kind of drop out of the sky these days.
I'm going to write a book about my adventures of my government posting around the world. It's a chapter of my posting in the sovereign nation of the Lakota people. I'm going to put in there about how I heard the giant spring pull somebody walking down the street up into the atmosphere. That's how they're losing all their people. Because the FBI comes in and they can't find anybody. That's missing. They never find them. So, giant spring, I heard, you know, pull somebody up into the air. It sounded, it was the strangest sound. Boing.
Okay. I don't exactly know how you would get a spring to do that. Because it has to be based on in something. You can't have a kind of a spring in space. How would you maneuver it? And then how would you grab the person? And then once you grab the person, what would you do with them? So it tends to generate about 10,000 questions more than the original question is answered. Okay, I guess Ken passed through the range for his transmission. I no longer see him on the link. So Dakota Springs. That's the new one. I just hope the YouTube people don't grab it and run with it like they did with Flat Earth. Anyway, it's been fun. I hope you enjoyed it as well. I get to put my my puzzles back in my back pocket, and hopefully I'll bring them out next Sunday night. Thanks to everyone who participated, and please come back next Sunday. But for now, let's move on to the Space Net Report with Paul WS2S.
Quick question.
Yes, Ed?
When Ken disappeared, did you hear a point?
Very good, Ed. Very good. Extra credit. Gold star. No. He went out with a whimper.
Okay. Let me see if I have it. I do. That was very good, Ed. And, okay, boy. AC2GSWS2N for the SpaceNet report. And this evening, the main topic, of course, is the Artemis 1 mission to the moon. Unmanned, but next time around it will be. And they predict that sometime at the end of next year. And, of course, that was all based on how successful this flight is, and so far the expectations have been beat by quite a bit, according to Mike Safran, one of the head people involved with this project. So things are going well. You can get an update on this. I don't know if any of you guys have the Alexa at home. What if you do, and you say, Alexa, take me to the moon? They'll give you an update every 24 hours, and it's a 26-day mission, so we've got a lot of days left. And they tell you how far away Orion is from Earth, and how close it is to the moon, and what their next steps are, and how many thrusters they fired, and all that type of thing. And then they go away for 24 hours, and the next day you say the same thing, take me to the moon. So I have that. It's a lot of fun to do that. Let me drop it. Okay. Anyway, they managed to get it off the ground. They've been bringing that rocket out to the launch pad since March, and quite a few times they had to bring it back to the vehicle assembly building. They tried to launch a number of different times. They brought it out originally just to make sure everything was set right, and then they brought it back, and then they brought it back out to the launch pad again, and they were planning on launching it. They had leak problems, hydrogen leak problems, other problems. They overcame all those problems eventually. Hurricane problems, they decided to put it away back in the vehicle assembly building for the first hurricane, Ian, and then the second hurricane that came out, Nicole, they actually left it out. They figured the winds weren't going to be strong enough, but actually it was about five miles an hour lower than the required, the predicted amount that this thing was good for. They figured at the 100-foot level, 85 miles an hour would be the max, and I think they got up to 80 miles an hour. So and they naturally reviewed everything afterwards and made sure everything was okay. Turns out some RTV materials, like silicone, you can buy RTV in a store, different types of RTV, use it for gaskets and that type of thing. And they use it as a filler to go all the way around the whole Orion spacecraft. Whole diameter of it, which is like 16 and a half feet diameter. So, gives you an idea how much of the stuff they use. Some of it peeled off due to the high winds, and there was questions about it, whether or not this was going to be a problem. If it falls off during launch, you're going to have a similar problem like we had with the Challenger. It's going to hit an important component. And anyway, it reviewed it and looked at it, and they decided it wasn't going to be a problem. So they decided to launch, and where they did, took off on Wednesday morning, We're supposed to go up 104,
yeah, you know, right after midnight,
early in the morning. But it was late a bit to almost 2 o'clock in the morning. I tried to stay up for it, but toward the end, it looked like they were going to go to 3 o'clock, and then before you know it, I'd have to stay up until 4 or 5 o'clock. I didn't change my circadian rhythm good enough to do that. But actually, the next morning, I got to review everything. The NASA site is good. You know, everything's recorded, you know, everything that they did. They can actually go through the whole, you know, 5 or 6 hours of preparations before launch. You get to see all the little details, documentaries. NASA does a good job at that. So, sure enough, it did successfully take off, before they did, by the way, they did have one problem with a hydrogen leak in one of the big valves. They have an 8-inch line that feeds the core stage, and the reason for that delay from 104 to almost 2 o'clock in the morning was because of that leak. They sent their crew out, they call it their red crew. So the team goes out, turned out to be 3 fellas, and they, you know, they go out to a live rocket. I mean, this thing is filled up with almost a million pounds of fuel. You know, 750,000 gallons of hydrogen, liquid hydrogen, and maybe almost 300,000 gallons of liquid oxygen. So they went out. They got to the pad. They had to go up all these different steps and then back down to other steps to get close to the rocket. They located the hydrogen valve that was leaking. Small leak, but you know, it was over their limits. And they put a couple of wrenches on it, and it was the packing. You know, if you ever look at these valves, you know, kind of big valve. They have big packing around it, and which is, you know, a steel inside the stem of the valve. They had to be torqued down and tightened, you know, tighten a series of bolts. And they did that successfully, and they were able to take off, which was really quite exciting to see the thing take off. So, yeah, it was on a lot of news shows. So anybody that pays attention to that, pretty amazing to see 8.8 million pounds of thrust leave the launch pad. Pretty cool. Just thinking about something else I was going to say with the launch. It went off successfully. The solid boosters lit up. The four engines, which are reused engines from the shuttle era, RS-25 engines, each put out over 500,000 pounds of thrust. So the four engines were, you know, a little over 2 million pounds of thrust. And the solids, the one on the starboard port, they lit off. And each one of those puts out like 3.5 million pounds of thrust. Anyway, it brings you to around 8.8 million pounds on liftoff. Solid separated after a little over 2 minutes, and that leaves the core and the interim cryogenic propulsion stage, essentially the third stage. And the core stage kept firing for a total of, from launch to MECO, main engine shutdown, was a little over 8 minutes.
Question.
Oh, okay, and then the propulsion stage kicked in for a short period of time. Then eventually that had to be relit again to go to the moon. But question, go ahead.
I have liquid nitrogen plus my lab, and I know that nitrogen cannot be stored. It has to leak. Maybe Dr. Roy can also the information why. And how do they manage to store that before the start? I assume that's the major problem with the delay. If one start doesn't go successfully and they have to delay it. Becky.
You talk about the nitrogen that they have for other purposes. But, yeah, that's not part of the fueling. But, you know, the fuel is the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen.
That's correct, but they use liquid nitrogen for cooling out the fuel. Since the nitrogen cannot be stored, how do they manage the production or because the evaporation of it is quite enormous.
Okay. Around the pad, anyway, they use instead of liquid nitrogen as inert gas to get rid of any of the fumes from the hydrogen. They actually use liquid helium, and that, you know, that's being spread from the pad, not from the rocket itself. Any liquid nitrogen on board is stored in composite wrapped tanks. So they're aluminum tanks and they're wrapped with carbon tape. And then it's treated and sealed. That holds pretty good. I mean, they send those things up to the space station, and they don't have a problem with it. It's stored on station. So, you know, I don't know what the leakage rate is, but nitrogen, for instance, on the space station, and that actually can't be reused. Reuse the oxygen on the space station. It's stored, as far as I know. You can keep that for quite a long time. We used to use it at work all the time. We had nitrogen bottles, and I never remember them ever leaking. They used to come in around 3,600 pounds. We used to use them all the time. But I don't remember having problems with these things leaking.
The jewel that I have is 5 gallons of liquid nitrogen that for my EDXRF is good for about 5 days, so that the evaporation rate cannot have it locked stored. Another question, right, liquid helium. Helium is a sore shortage. Maybe Dr. Roy could say some words.
I don't know what you were talking about. I got distracted here.
Okay. Enormous amount of nitrogen, when it's used for cooling, must evaporate. So if one stage of the start doesn't go good, they have to delay it, and the delay may take hours or weeks sometimes. And the question is how do they manage that, because with such a volume of nitrogen, there's a huge amount of evaporation that is taking place. I believe I pronounced it properly. As far as the helium is, helium used instead of liquid nitrogen, and then we have a shortage of the air with the helium, so how do they manage that? Maybe you know about it, Dr. Rick.
Well, I mean, government funds can support buying expensive stuff. We have a shortage globally, but if you got enough government money, you can buy almost as much helium as you want to buy.
Okay, well, I have a generator that is, actually it's not a generator, it's like I have a cold finger, which is cooled by liquid helium, and just to buy a few pounds of helium, it is a big problem. right now to heat it up, because from time to time I have to heat it up. So what it does is when the gaseous nitrogen N2 is passing by the, around the cold finger, which is a piece of copper extending from the probe, then it drops in form of droplets to the bottom of the dewar, and that's how I get the liquid nitrogen for it. But then again, if I see that my level of helium is low, then I have a big problem and I have to stop the production. So, you say you can buy as much of the helium as you want, but why are they talking constantly about the shortage of it?
Because globally there is a shortage. It's not a forever thing. You use it, it escapes, it goes past the atmosphere, and you got it. Most of our helium is mined in cavities where it is trapped as decay products of other objects. So there's an absolute supply that we don't know, you know, like fossil fuels and such. And so a lot of it goes into kind of goofy re-parties and such. So all things being equal, they would like people to not waste the helium, but governments always waste supplies. And they usually have very good pipelines of getting supplies and a lot of money to pay for them. So although globally we have a helium shortage, for some purposes, the government probably doesn't act that way.
Okay, Paul, how do they manage that with helium? Maybe you can add to it.
Well, I don't know. They don't have that problem with the phase line system. I mean, any helium that they are using, they flood it through the system to make sure that the hydrogen doesn't pose a problem, and they have, you know, helium lines running through, the, you know, from tanks that are out in the field. So I think that's going to be more of a problem with SpaceX. They use a lot of the helium for some of their work. Anyway, the nitrogen bottle, by the way, we used to get deliveries of. They used to come to the job site. Thousands of pounds of pressure inside the thing. And, you know, it could be like a month later, 2 months later, you roll the tank out to it. But we would hook it up to a manifold setup, and we would test piping systems throughout the building. Some of these piping systems were large, you know, I mean, millennia cubic feet. And we used to open the valve and raise the pressure up to a couple of hundred pounds. And shut the valve down, and then wait for 2 hours to see if the needle moves at all. You know, leave it, say, 200 pounds. And if it doesn't move, you know, it's pretty much good to go. Then we used to actually fill it up with water, and another manifold set up. And again, pump that, and now you would actually pump those systems up to a 200-pound level. Again, leave it that way. If that was successful, you know, good to go. Whatever you were piping systems for, now accepted. But anyway, I just wanted to finish up a little bit more with the baseline system. The Artemis system successfully separated from the core stage and then the interim cryogenic propulsion stage, which is, again, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. That puts out a thrust of 25, almost 25,000 pounds of thrust, and that pushes them to the moon if they go through what they call TLI, translunar injection. So after one trip around the Earth, this thing pushed the Orion spacecraft on the way to the moon, which is going ever since Wednesday, and will be arriving tomorrow morning at 7:15, NASA will start transmitting again on their NASA TV. And that's when it's going to go into distant retrograde orbit, and it'll go about 80 miles above the surface of the moon, and then go slightly behind the planet, and then without anything, autonomously, it will fight its engine. In this case, it has the Gnome's engine, which is 6,000 pounds thrust as part of the Orion spacecraft. And the European Space Agency service module will light up. It's called the Ohms engine. And that's a relic from the, again, the space shuttle system. They have two Ohms engines, every space shuttle. Well, they're using one of them now for this purpose. It's at the hypergolic fuel. That's not liquid hydrogen, but liquid oxygen. And you don't need a spark plug to get that thing going. Once it mixes with the nitrogen tetroxide, it automatically ignites, and no problem. That's what early tomorrow morning will bring. It goes into this distant retrograde orbit, the aerotic orbit, which is going to be around almost 40,000 miles away from the surface of the moon. Retrograde, meaning they really haven't described that too good. But, you know, the direction where the moon travels around the sun, it's actually going to be opposite that direction, all the way out to around 40,000 miles away from the surface. It'll stay there around 6 days, and then, 4 days from now, it will do one more burn to keep it in that retrograde orbit. And then it'll coast for around 6 days. And they're going to run all the tests and everything that they want to do with Orion for all those days. And then they'll reignite again, two more burns, eventually coming very close to the surface of the moon again. If I'm on the outward direction. And then another 3.5-4 days before it gets back to their Earth gravitational well, and then they'll go through the using the heat shield, and then eventually 11 parachutes that will come out to slow it down to land in the Pacific Ocean. So if there was a crew on board, they would successfully have made it all the way around the moon and back. That will see what they will do next time. Except it won't be a 26-day mission. It'll probably be about an 8 to 10-day mission with a crew on board of four people. 2 months from now, they plan on picking the crew, so that'll be in the news, the actual crew that will be going on that flight. We'll see. On the way to the moon, when the interim biogenic propulsion stage separated, that's a 25,000-pound engine built by Aerojet. When its job was over after translunar injection, after TLI, that separated from the Orion spacecraft along with the service module. Inside the interim cryogenic propulsion stage, they had 10 CubeSats. Those 10 CubeSats successfully separated. I've been keeping track to try to figure out how many they've actually made contact with. I could do that by going to the Deep Space Network website. And so far they've made contact with the Lunar Ice Cube mission. These are all roughly 50-pound CubeSats. You know, they have one thruster system, they have solar panels, they put out roughly around 30 or 40 watts of power for these things to operate. So that thing was, I'm sure that made contact with the space network, along with the near-Earth asteroid scout mission. That one is interesting. That one has a solar panel system that's going to open up. That's the telescopic holes that are going to open up, roughly 20 feet long, and it's going to create this very fine mylar solar sail, and we'll use the sun's light to push it along, and it'll go actually around the sun, in the next year or so, it will, I think next September, it will come close to an asteroid. This asteroid is around 300 feet diameter. And we'll take pictures of the asteroid and everything, so this experimental satellite should be interesting. It's got a long life to it. That was heard from by the Deep Space Network, as well as the BioSentinel mission, that one as well. That one's got some kind of yeast on board. They're going to try to see how it affects it, similar to what happens to human DNA. So that's an experiment. It's also heading around the moon. Lunar IR, LUNIR, that's another one with infrared on it, big pictures of the moon. CubeSat, that's been another CubeSat called CUSP, the Solar Particle Sat. There's a series of them, launch maps, like this one, Argo Moon. Argo Moon is a it's equipped with a camera, and when it's separated from the interim cryogenic propulsion stage, its job is actually to take a picture of that stage all around it, give the engineers details on how that thing performs. So those pictures should be pretty good when they eventually download them through the Deep Space Network. Looking forward to the Argo CubeSat. Something called the T-Miles CubeSat, and another one called Equidolis is another one that's been heard from. And another one that I haven't seen that one has been heard from yet. It's actually a lander. They plan on landing this thing on the moon. It's got an airbag, and it's going to like crash land onto the moon and send signals back. Hopefully that one works good. It's Omenta Nashi, which is a Japanese one. It's quite so hard to pronounce. It's made in Japan. But NASA also put some kind of experiment on board, so they're involved with it. But the interesting part about it has a 430 megahertz UHF transmitter on board. So amateurs should be able to hear this if you have a, you know, good enough antenna and good enough receiver on 438. But don't have the exact frequency yet. Looking forward to that. See what happens. I thought I would have seen this on like the AMSAT site. I'm going to try again to try to find that that frequency. I don't have a 70 centimeter antenna for it, but you know, anybody that does gets the right frequency to be able to hear this thing as it's sitting on the moon if it's intact. We'll see what happens with that one. Anyway, there's 10 of these things. Originally, there were going to be 13, but a couple of them didn't make it in time for launch. So, let me drop it. This is WS1. Okay, there is a picture of what, you know, the tail end of what the spacecraft looks like, taken from deep space. It's got Earth in the background. It's a real nice picture. If you go to Roy's website, roy.ac2gs.com, you bring that up, you'll see what that looks like. Next week, I'll be putting another picture. They have another selfie of the spacecraft itself, the Orion spacecraft itself. If there was a crew in it, they'd be able to wave to you. It's a very good picture. It has cameras all over it. It's got roughly around 20 cameras inside and outside of the vehicle. And the way they're getting these pictures, selfie pictures with the Earth in the background. There's another one with the moon in the background. Is on the end of the solar panels that opened up. When this thing took off, you know, after the interim cryogenic propulsion stage separated, they have four panels that opened up. They were covered up by they call it the ogive, the covering. When it took off, well, that's all gone now. So the panels open up, and they're supposed to be able to put out 11 kilowatts of power. Turns out they're putting out more. So expectations are being beat. But on the ends of these four panels, solar panels that open up, there's three tips. They have cameras on each one, each tip. So there's four cameras. They're able to take pictures of the spacecraft itself, also of the Earth and the Moon. The way they're getting those pictures, they're not wired into, there's no wire that's running down to the side of it. Side of these solar panels into the vehicle. It's Wi-Fi, so they have a Wi-Fi set up. And they're testing it to get all the data, you know, through the Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi slows down when all four cameras are working at the same time, so they just decide to work one camera at a time. But I thought that was pretty cool. No wiring necessary. Just put a camera at the end of the solar panel and it's good to go. And then there's a series of other cameras bouncing around on the outside and inside. The inside shows the man module. One picture I saw where they're looking at the, it looks like there's an astronaut on board. That's a mannequin. So name for Moonikin. Well, Moonikin has got a complete spacesuit on, tons of sensors on board. When they eventually get Orion back, if it lands in the Pacific Ocean, they'll be able to download all that information. They said there's like hundreds of sensors involved with this and two other mannequins as well. So they don't want to waste valuable RF time. Get all that money. You know, after they land, they're busy getting other telemetry, other important stuff that they need to know about Orion. This is test flight. So I thought that was pretty good. Any questions or comments? WS. Okay. Meanwhile, the other day, the Capstone satellite that was launched a couple of months ago from New Zealand. That was on an Electron rocket. Talk about a carbon structure. That whole rocket is 3D manufactured with some carbon vehicle. Anyway, they had a payload on board called Capstone, and eventually arrived in orbit around the moon. It took a long time to get there. It passed the moon. The idea was to go around 800,000 miles past the moon, almost a million miles past the moon. And eventually it came back on its own, planned that way. Gravitational well of the moon pulled it into a near retrolinear orbit, halo orbit, they call it. And that's sitting in orbit. So a lot of things going on with the moon now. Eventually, that thing, I think I talked about this last week, will run some tests, location check tests. Instead of a GPS, it's going to use the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is in orbit around the moon, 2009. We'll be testing with that, making sure that orbit is stable. Okay, they know it will be. And once they get the data back on that, that will give them more confidence of eventually putting Gateway into orbit around the moon in that that particular orbit. And that will eventually, eventually have like two or three astronauts on board that on a regular basis. They'll be, for months on end. So send another crew to meet up with them and hang out in the space station around the moon before you get into another vehicle and go down to the moon on a human landing system, HLS they call it, and then come back from the moon and dock with the space station. From there, get back into Orion and head back to the the Pacific Ocean again. Any comments or questions for the SpaceNet report? WS. So much going on in space lately. Well, with it is pretty incredible. Last week we had three EVAs done by three different groups, one by NASA. They needed to do an EVA on the space station, putting out solar panels, new solar panels, and trying to get the solar panel output 165 kilowatts, and then trying to bring it up to around 210 kilowatts. And they've already successfully have done this on previous EVAs. Now they're doing another set. Eventually, I think two more sets after that. That have to be done next year or two. But it takes a couple of spacewalks to complete that. This one was, the idea was to set up structures, support for the ROSA, they call them rollout solar arrays, ROSA systems. They're going to supplement the electrical power on board the space station. Actually, the solar panels that are there tend to degrade over time, so they've actually, lost power a little bit. But they need these not only to get back to the power where they, the maximum that they had, they want to go beyond that. Just never figured to use as much power as they're using. There's so many experiments, hundreds of experiments that are going on a 24-hour basis on the space station. They need electric power. Then when visiting spacecraft come up and dock with the space station, they need to supply power to those vehicles so that they can stay on board for extended periods of time, sometimes 6 months or so at a time. So they need more power. That was only one set of EVAs that was done. Another one was done by China on a completely different space station. Every other people flying around, humans on another space station, they had to do an EVA. Back on the International Space Station on the Russian end, Las Cosmos, which is the complement to NASA, the Russian side needed to do an EVA. They were improving their side. They use a robotic arm, and they need a nail lock on the end of that new module that they had put up there. In case they need to add new modules or more equipment, they'll have that capability. So, like I said, quite a bit going on back on Earth. This week, ABL, another small rocket company right now, will be trying to get their first rocket into orbit. So many companies like this. This is just another one. And they plan on launching from Kodiak, Alaska, the Pacific launching facility that the United States has in Alaska. So they plan on using a flight going into a polar orbit, which plan on doing many flights like that. Get that contract lined up. So they're hoping that they're first flight will be successful. That should happen this week. Any other comments or questions before we turn it back to Roy? This is WS Plans for the Space Night Report. Nothing heard? You're frank. I probably have not left enough time for Echo Link, but anyway, we'll do that now. If nothing's heard, Roy, you pick it up.
I'm leaving to the Bellevue. I'm going to unlock the phone to get on here. We haven't heard very much about Starship lately. So I actually haven't seen the videos. Anything new on that?
they still plan on launching something by the end of the year. Highly doubtful, though. You know, they got another month or so left to do that. The employees are getting a little irritated from what I read. Some of them are basically they're saying, you know, leave us alone, you know, just talking about Musk. You know, let us do what we like doing. They're getting fed up. So, yeah, they have their problems. They have tested another, I think, 13 engines out of 30 engines. They light them off at one time. Started with 7 and 13. They plan on doing eventually all 30. You know, after, you know, it's all bubbled down and they're not going anywhere. So they like to test all engines before they actually commit to launch. I guess if they can get that done, they'll probably put everything back together again. That means putting Starship on top of the booster and seeing if they could make their first orbital mission. Actually, it won't be a whole orbit. They'll get as far as Hawaii and then back down into the ocean for their first flight. So nothing will be recoverable. The booster will, you know, will wind up in the Gulf of Mexico, and the Starship itself will wind up in off the coast of Hawaii somewhere. But, I don't know. Maybe Elon is preoccupied. Back to your friend.
Yeah, I tweeted to him today, something around his Twitter, and gets back to building Starship. I was tempted to tell him take Starship to you know where, but I decided they might not let me send that. Anyway, yeah, I think everybody's going to be set up with it. I would like to see this thing launched. I think that's kind of more meaningful contribution we can make to humankind than twittering around. So, let's set up that. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, they really need to get going because, you know, they have a contract for the human landing on the moon. The HLS, the human landing system. NASA gave them the contract. You know, they're supposed to be orbiting the moon, and by 2025, which would be Artemis 3, ready there, and then when Orion comes out, Orion crew is supposed to dock with it. Crew is supposed to get into Starship, go down, land on the moon, and then come back up. Yeah, see that anywhere near being ready for 2025. I mean, they don't have their first orbital flight. You know, I hope I'm wrong. You know, I hope they get one flight after the other. I know he's still been, you know, he builds things like mass production, like the Tesla cars. So hopefully that's the way it goes, but I don't see it. And then NASA gave them another contract for Artemis 4 after that. The only good news I see is that NASA finally came around, you know, maybe because they realize they have more money now because of the build back better money, whatever it was, the infrastructure money. I think more of it will eventually get to, you know, it's going to get to NASA. Anyway, they are letting contracts out to build another one or maybe two different HLS systems, human landing system, which was, you know, they're actually going back to Plan A. Lockheed was instrumental in building a lander. They were in cooperation with Blue Origin. Blue Origin was developing the rocket. I guess they still are the actual landing rocket for that, for the DC-7. And that was going to be a landing rocket to get them off the moon. And I like that design that they had. It looked good. It wasn't this humongous thing that SpaceX has. That looked good. And Dynetics had another design. It was a nice design.